Welcome.
Dan Levitard, if we're really being honest about it, it's just a giant piece of shit.
To the Big Suey.
Bald Eagles.
A podcast exclusive that none of our bosses asked for.
More sports.
More work. Less pay.
I haven't stopped talking in a month. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Just when you thought the show couldn't be more diluted. Bam.
Last time I listened to this show.
I haven't listened for years.
Now here's the marching band to nowhere.
Am I missing something? What am I missing?
The end of the story.
Fat face.
Chris Fallick.
It's Felica. You made him a penis.
And the habitual liar.
I didn't ask for any of
it. You asked for all of it.
The Big Suey.
I'm Chris Cody, BSPN.
So many of you know, if you've been listening to this show for a long time, that I have learned a great deal about racial strife in this country from Bomani Jones. I think he's the best I've ever seen at talking about some of this stuff in terms of being able to be informed and having a historical experience and life experience that allows him to sort of explain to us things that we might not have seen for ourselves. So Breonna Taylor, this incident is amazing to watch. Incident isn't even a strong enough word, but you get into a position where in very real ways, the crime is not shooting a black woman, it's missing. The charges are for having missed her and endangered others in an apartment, according to her lawyer, where white people lived. So Bomani Jones with us now, and thank you for joining us, Bo. I'm just curious because you've known every time one of these things crops up, you're always like, and it's historically so, you're not even cynical about it, just realistic. It's like, yeah, there won't be any charges here. These aren't going to be cop charges. And so you experience what happened in Louisville here. How?
Honestly, not at all. Myself, and I don't want to say this in any judgment to anybody else for feeling what they feel, because this is like emotionally incapacitated a lot of people. And I think especially younger people, because I feel like in some ways this is kind of their first like really conscious rodeo with this sort of thing. Like I saw Malika Andrews on television, you know, the thing with her, and like the Mike Brown thing was 6 years ago. So she was what, like 19 when that happened? Which then means you're like 17 when Trayvon Martin happened. So like, I don't know how you consume or how you dealt with those things, you know, after they happen. But with Trayvon Martin, it was a terrible story when it happened. But I was like, okay, after they took all that time before they even decided to do any sort of investigation, well, you know, there's not going to be anything that happens on the back end. Like, it's going to be functionally impossible for there to be something that happens on the back end of that one. And what was informative to me about the case with Mike Brown was the district attorney in St. Louis at the time said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to present the evidence to the grand jury and then we're going to let them make a decision. And I was always under the impression that they played to win, right? Like the way he put it was just like, yeah, we're just going to throw some stuff up there in front of them and just see what they have to say about this. That's not how this works. If they want you to be indicted, they go in there to indict you. Like the prosecutor is not there taking surveys. Prosecutor's there trying to get people indicted. And he's like, well, he just made it clear they weren't going to try to get the dude indicted. Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't, but they weren't going to try to do that. And so what happens in this case for me, like it was informed by all of that history and knowing that how this goes. And the worst part about this is the law is what was going to make it impossible for anybody to go to jail. Like they got it set up in this way. I talked about this on one of my podcasts. And I've talked about this before, that the way that the law is written in a lot of ways for cops and the way that they talk about these things is basically you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Like they feel as though in order for them to be able to do their jobs, every now and then somebody's going to have to get shot when they shouldn't. Like that's just the only way that they're going to be able to do this. Right. And boom, there it goes. And so for me, that is what this case was. I think that the laws are written as they are with kind of black people or black victims in mind. But what happened to her, if she had been a white woman laying in her bed in the same way, this probably plays out the same. Now, there's maybe a different level of outrage from different sets of people about it. But in terms of the way that the statute is written, this is going to go the same. Like the police unions in all these different places, have amassed the level of power that's allowed them to basically set up the rules so that they don't go to jail if they kill somebody. Like, it's there. It was set up. So hearing that the grand jury had only indicted the cop for shooting into the other apartment, I've made peace with that already. Like, this was what the ending was going to be. There was nothing. This was not a climax to me when they made, you know, when they said they were going to announce what was going to happen with the cops. No, this was already over for me. So whatever pain and anguish that I was going to feel about it was going to be felt by finding out about the story. Because even let's say they had indicted these cops, which is a really low bar, right? Let's say they had indicted the cops. Now, let's say they convicted the cops. And like in the grand scheme, like you realize how little we're talking about scraping for and fighting for is one conviction in an egregious case would have been cause for people to be dancing in the streets because the things askew so far in the other direction. The dude, Walter Scott in South Carolina, who we saw on tape get shot in the back by the police, they convicted that officer. They did. It ain't like, what did it change? Like I would feel differently about taking a celebratory or being overly disappointed, a celebratory run when somebody gets convicted, or being highly disappointed when somebody does not, if I felt like any one of these convictions was then subsequently going to lead to like a domino effect of that becomes the way things go. This thing is set up in a way that that's not going to happen that way. Like, what there is to have anguish about is not this particular case, but the fact that after cops kill somebody in a case like this, they know that they can go home and go to sleep, right? Like, and that's a macro level thing that for me is not going to change based on any one individual case.
Well, what is the structural change that you've heard? Like, this stuff is so difficult to move a mountain on. Like, what could possibly be a structural change that makes sense to you that as being possible?
Well, in some way, those laws are going to need to be rewritten. Because if you don't change the laws, no matter how fervent the prosecutor is, like the dude, you know, they got the Black Republican Attorney General in Kentucky, and he's the face of a lot of this and taking a lot of scorn and ire, some of which I think is absolutely justified. But even if Thurgood Marshall were the district attorney of the state of Kentucky, he couldn't do anything about what the laws actually are that are in place. Like, if there's a structural, I don't know if there's a structural change that can happen. What does kind of have to happen to me, we have to evaluate what we mean when we call people heroes or when we decide that somebody is a hero. And so I have read a lot about how police officers will talk about their number one job is to come home to their families, which I think is like totally human and understandable. And I believe that if I were in a position like that, there's a good chance that my view on it would be that nothing is more important than me getting home to my family. I think I would probably feel that way. I'm also not a hero. That's not what it is. Like, when we talk about heroes, we talk about people that run into burning buildings, and I might not make it out of here, but I'm going to try to get some kids out of here. Right? Like, that's how we think about it. Like, a friend of mine makes the point that if firefighters use the same standard as we allow police to use, buildings would burn down all the time. You know, like if a firefighter's number one duty is, I got to get home, then all kinds of stuff would burn down. Like, that's not what it is. That's not what the game is. Like, when we talk about the first responders at 9/11, what makes them heroes is the risk that they were willing to take in order to do something, you know, by their fellow man. Like, that's what did it. That's not really the standard that we hold police to, except anytime something happens, we then turn them into heroes. And if you want to say that the police are doing heroic work, I think that's a fine like hypothesis to start with. Then you got to explain to me what it is about their work it is that makes it heroic. And I think the argument that most people would make is that they risk their lives in order to do their jobs, and therefore they are heroic. Cool. Got you. Except you let them opt out of the heroism when it's needed to be or when it is convenient. And again, I would probably take the same approach in the same place, but I ain't no hero.
So when people say vote and these are elected official positions, if you want to change the system, you're saying, yeah, not so much. Like, it's not vote an elected official. If we're following the law, whether we're black and white, and you're saying it's a helpless foregone conclusion the way everything's set up.
Well, so let's think about this with the idea of like electing people, right? I say this as an apolitical observation. Barack Obama got elected in 2008. Once the Republicans had control of the Senate, they basically made the decision, we're not letting you do anything, right? Like, even like you say, this is your vote, right? It doesn't work exactly that way. You know, you change over a couple of people in some offices. It doesn't necessarily mean that what's going to follow is X, Y, and Z. Now, this is what I do think about voting. And I think that this is kind of where it matters on like matters of police stuff. You got a better chance of having an effect with your vote on local issues, like local ordinances and things like that in local offices, than you do with the larger stuff. Right. You've got that chance and you can do something there. And I think that that's the big part of voting. Like, we keep telling people to vote, but I think that we probably need to be more specific and say, pay real attention to what's going on with local politics and with your local ballot, because that's probably the place where you as an individual probably have a greater effect and have a better chance at making something happen. But just blanketly saying voting, like, OK, well, we can get, you know, I think his name is Daniel Cameron, right? We can get Daniel Cameron out of office in Kentucky. Again, you can put somebody else in there, but if the laws are as they are, then you can't do anything about it. Now, that, I believe, is where you start looking at like state legislatures. And John Oliver did something really good a couple of years ago about state legislatures. Look that up. Like, the state legislature game is where things are real kooky and the district lines are drawn in such a way that even by voting, there's only but so much that you can do to impact the level of change, because once people get power, they rig it such that they can keep it. That's the number one priority, is the maintenance of power. So you've got something there. But I also think that, especially when it comes to things with the police, we're still not doing this right in the sense that the police did not begin to behave the way they did by accident. They didn't get to this point by accident. They have historically operated with a mandate from the people, right? Like, the median American has approved of the ways that the police have dealt with things over the years. And so if the median American doesn't look at this and say to themselves, whoa, man, we got a problem, then the structural change, that you got a lot of votes to try to get together, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make there. And think about it in this way. You see the story about this autistic boy in Utah that got shot in the back by the cops.
Yes.
Like, apparently, yeah, he was having some problem, whatever. His mom called the cops. And then the cops came and they shot this 11-year-old kid in the back. Hey, man, ain't nothing really happening about that. Like, all the way to the point where you don't even see like right wing people being like, well, why aren't you talking about this 11-year-old boy? Like, it's not even happening. Like, there's a whole lot of people in this country have made the decision that a lot of things that the cops are going to do, that for whatever reason, they're willing to ride with. And I think about that story with that 11-year-old, kind of like people with the gun control debate, where public opinion is in favor of gun control, but the power dynamics are skewed such that the gun control thing doesn't change. But I think it was after Newtown where they're like, look, man, if this didn't shake people, it ain't happening. And I feel like if an 11-year-old white boy gets shot in the back, and this doesn't really shake people, I don't know what's going to shake them.
So when you talk with this sort of practical numbness about this stuff, one of the things that is different or has to be stark to you is video in Louisville of people who don't have any seeming affiliation to law enforcement marching around armed to the teeth with weaponry that's totally scary, feeling like it's their job to make sure that protesters don't protest too much. Like, that you can't be practically numb to, can you?
No, I am not practically numb to it. But I recognize the thing about that is they're doing that for one reason, because they know the cops ain't going to shoot them. Like, I don't know if you remember, what was it, in Dallas, where there was the big rally a few years ago, and then somebody got shot, and there was this black dude who was walking around with his assault rifle, because Texas, right? Like, you know, you can do that in Texas. He's got that thing strapped across his body, and he's walking around, and somebody got shot. And he's walking and he's like, I need to find a police officer and give him my gun. Right. Like immediately. Why? Because he knows they might shoot him for that. These folks know they rolling however deep into these spots with these guns because they know that nobody is going to shoot them. When that kicker for the Patriots, he didn't wind up making the team. The one they drafted that had that white supremacist tattoo on him. The members of that group had shown up at some, like, a recruiting center. I want to say it was in Tennessee, but they had shown up at this recruiting center, a bunch of them with all their guns, and the Army sent a letter out to let the people know who worked at the recruiting center, basically be nice to those people, don't engage them, but be polite and everything else, and then just go in there and do your job. That was the Army saying,
We need to be nice to these people because otherwise they might start shooting. Like that's what tells you everything you need to know.
Well, when people try and condense this stuff to everything you need to know, what am I supposed to rebut when the symbolism is this stark, Bomani? Because honest to God, it is appalling in 2020 when this is how our country is and all the information we have about what the last few months have felt like. And you get into a situation where two cops are getting no charges and the only one who's getting charges is not who killed. It's not for killing Breonna Taylor. It is for endangering the white people next door. And yes. And it's not for endangering the black people next door.
No, and there were black people next door.
But that's what I'm saying, Bomani. Like that is too difficult to believe. The symbol is, it can't be that, can it? Like, it can't be. We're gonna value by law and by charges something that stark, where we're gonna value white life more than black life in a way that's plain to see.
Yep, right there. And it's the same thing with the white dudes walking around with them hammers, going through the street, deciding that they themselves are going to maintain law and order, right? Like it's people can't act like they don't know. Like I used to operate when I talked about a lot of these things, like, you know, I guess 8 to 10 years ago, more so, where I did honestly feel like I was dealing with a lot of people who did not understand the point. You know, like I think that it was easy for them, given what things were, to not like fully get what it was. And people very often have a moment or something happen that just shakes them and they're like, oh, man, this is what it is. Like, I think Breonna Taylor would be that for some people. But I mean, it's been laid so bare. Like I talk, it's interesting that for all the, you know, people who get with me on like the stick to sports stuff, you'll notice I have had very little to say about Donald Trump since he won the Republican nomination in 2016, because to me, it was like, there's nothing else to say. Like, everything is here right in front of you. There's nothing else to be explained. It's all been laid bare. And I feel like for the last 4 years of the administration, you can look at the tenor of the campaign that Trump has run. It's right there, right? There's the game in this is not decoded, right? This isn't about a Southern strategy anymore where you find different issues to try to cover up what it is. Even when they try to use some of those classic Southern strategy issues like the suburbs and stuff like that, even when they do that, they give the game away why they do it. Like, they ain't even got to say the suburbs part anymore because it's so transparent what it is that is being offered. It is right here in front of people right now. And if people have picked the side that is against those who are like, hey, we're kind of scared of getting shot by the police, then I don't know how to reason with them anymore. I don't know how to argue with them anymore. I think the thing that we have to do with them is stop pretending like they need the benefit of the doubt on this. They have sacrificed the benefit of the doubt. We are where we are. This is what this is. People have to stop pretending.
I just find exasperating, just really exasperating. These are not controversial requests. Please have the police stop being brutal with us, and please listen to us. We are in pain. Just listen to us. And everything's a fight, though, Bo. Like, it's not, I don't understand how there's an other side to those two things I just said.
Yeah, but here's the problem. So let's say that there's not an other side. Let's just throw it out there, right? Like, I have to record it after we do this, but I'm doing a parting shot about that dude in UFC, Colby Covington.
Yes.
I believe is his name.
Well, he's trafficking in this stuff the way that fighters, it's like he's missing by a note. He's trying to be the cartoon wrestler guy. And it doesn't seem sincere to me, but he seems like he's got a path to money the way Conor McGregor and Chael Sonnen with their mouth got a path to money.
Yeah. So the thing is, I think it's sincere, but also think it's performative. Like, I think it's rehearsed and, I think he's hitting all the major talking points, but I do believe that it is sincere. But here's the thing. If Dana's going to be at the Trump rallies, and then Dana's going to be at the Republican National Convention, and we're not going to say anything about Dana doing that. Like, the thing that makes Covington interesting to me is, as inflammatory as his rhetoric is, it is also the mainstream rhetoric of the president of the United States. And so once it becomes the rhetoric of the president, it almost becomes like in a protected class of that politics stuff, because if nothing else, we have established that there are some tens of millions of people who support the person that is behind this, right? Like, it's not like Covington is taking what Trump is saying and then taking it to this whole nother place where Trump will come behind it and be like, oh, wait a minute, that's not my message. No, he's spitting the exact
same. Well, he's calling him. He's calling. Trump is calling. It's not like Trump is making a whole lot of, like, he's doing this with Clay Travis by appearing on that show, which is just Breitbart Sports. Like, he is absolutely trafficking in the same constituency.
Right, but the question for me is not why Covington is allowed to do this without scrutiny. It's why does Dana White get to do this without scrutiny? Because Dana White is not saying the same things as Covington, but he is endorsing the same, a person who says the same things as Covington, and not just endorsing. The UFC has been used as a propaganda arm of this particular government. Like, we've seen, like, the promotional videos that the UFC has done behind Trump. So, like, to me, it's real easy to come on Covington, right? And just be like, oh, wow, he seems so boorish and he's saying everything else. Without saying the words, Dana White is saying the exact same thing.
But that's our job, Bo, and this is part of the
thing. That was my point.
This is maddening, though. It's our job, but we work under the umbrella of one of the few people who was making us money during the pandemic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm explaining, not excusing, because what you're saying is absolutely so. That basically, at a time where the political walls have fallen on the discourse at this network and everywhere, Dana White skates on the messaging while speaking at the Republican National Convention as a partner to this network.
Yeah, and then Dana's I don't know if interesting is the right way to put it, but, you know, we come on highly questionable all the time. So I've talked to Dana a lot, and I've only seen him once, but I was at my desk one day at the Seaport, minding my own business, and somebody tapped me. I had no idea what it was, and he was walking away because he was in a hurry, and it was Dana. He looked so incredibly happy to see me. You know what I mean? Like we're not talking about some dude that, like, can't stand to be in the presence of Black people or something like that. Like, that's not what it is, but this is not, he hasn't just put his name on it. He's put the name of the whole operation onto this, right? As quick as they were to try to push to get back in the time of COVID-19, it was hard to separate that from Dana's attachment to all of these other things. And I'm right there with you. It becomes a media situation. So, like, with Covington, for example, we don't have to put this stuff on TV. You know, when he gets out here and talks about Usman and says that he's a communist and a Marxist and he supports lifelong criminals, we don't have to put that on television. We don't have to give that eyeballs. Like, even if we're not going to get on here and chastise him at every turn for doing that, we don't have to be the ones to help him out in the course of that. Like, you can make the argument, okay, we're in business with Dana White. I guess we kind of got to let him ride, you know, for some of his affiliations. But we don't have to let Colby Covington, like, I don't know who that dude is.
Well, one of the things he did, and what are we supposed to do with this? Because in their back and forth, and I don't know if you heard it, maybe Michael get it here, and we'll play it for you if you haven't heard the specifics of the back and forth. But you and I have laughed about the idea that wrestling traffics in stereotypes in a way that's racist and hugely offensive, but also it's wrestling. And the fight game traffics in racism in a way that, well, hell, you will not go to a mixed culture fight between Black people and Mexican people.
No.
And I wonder how you fit that into what it is that we're talking about here when he says to Usman something about his tribe and smoke signal, something that is just, it's racist. And we were laughing about it earlier this week, not the racist part about it, but just how stupid this back and forth was with Covington. Have you heard this sound? Is this sound that you've heard the specifics of where Covington just gets mad and it's not even trash talk? It's just, it's a note off and Covington just gets angry because basically it's that video of Bill O'Reilly that you showed me where they were enjoying how much. Who were the guys that were enjoying how much?
Aaron Rod and Dave Dash. Yes. Yeah, they're just like, we have crashed the party.
Yeah, Bill O'Reilly was getting mad. Here's Covington. Let's play the sound for the audience in the event that they haven't heard it, where it's just, it's a note off, but also with some bonus racism on the front end.
He's so soft. You're soy boy soft.
Look at him.
He's so soft. You didn't even finish with him. You're so soft. Yeah, you never used. Who'd you get a call from? You get a call from freaking your little tribe? They give you some smoke signals for you?
Okay,
you're a joke, Marty. Fake news. Newsflash. You're a joke.
Hey,
guess what? You're fake news. No one cares about you.
You do?
You're pathetic.
Do you care about me?
No, yeah, because you got the worst decision in the history of the sport. So many bad calls against me. No, you didn't. I stood right up. That wasn't even close.
Face.
Marty Fake Newsman. You didn't break
your
my face. I got right up and protested right away. That was a fake stoppage, fake ref, fake fight. Wait till I see you next time. Wait till I see you next time, Marty Fake Newsman. You're dead.
We
got unfinished business.
Really?
You better show up.
Really?
I'm coming for you.
You said that last time. What happened?
Yeah, you wait till this time. You know who was winning fake stoppage. You didn't break none.
Broke
the only thing you broke
face.
Is your own will. You broke your spirit. That's why you're running from
I
me.
Did?
That's why you're hiding. You ain't nowhere to run, nowhere to hide now. Wait till I see you next time. You didn't finish Tyron Woodley like I did. You're dead. You're on borrowed time.
Who's worried? Hey, I'm not worried about Tyron Woodley. You're worried about me. Look at me.
Look at me.
Here.
Look at you.
Look
no
here.
One to look at your hairline.
Look
that shit's gone, bro. You're the ugliest dude in the history of the UFC. That hairline's halfway up
your face.
Stop doing steroids. Stop. You didn't break nothing. The
your
only
face.
Thing you broke is your will. You broke your will. You ain't.
Wow, I beat
you.
Breathe,
dude, what are you doing? Foot stomps? You're the boringest champ in the history of this company,
but
man.
I broke your face.
You didn't break anything.
That's
you broke
the important
your own will.
Thing.
You broke your own will. Why are you running? Why are you running? Come see me in the octagon then. See me. See what happens next time. Your best night, that was my worst night, and
what
I still beat
next
your
time?
Ass.
Okay,
tell me right now.
Tell me what happens next
I'm
time.
I'm knocking your ass out. You're going out cold. I guarantee it. Just like I wobbled you. I know you lost all those brain cells. I know you're dimensional right now and delusional. Wait till I see you next time, Marty Fake Newsman. You better train hard. Keep doing that EPO. Keep it up. I don't need nothing. This is raw American steel. I got the President of the United States. Dragon energy. When I see you, you're dead.
Do you think that ethically or journalistically we shouldn't be playing that?
I don't. Where it's tricky for me on that is I didn't watch whenever the last fight was that Buddy was in, but apparently, like, he had the crowd. Like, the crowd is with him. Like, the thing that's awkward about Trump is the majority of white people that voted for him. And that's in every demographic split, right? Like, it's basically white people voted for Trump and nobody else did. Like, that's the way that it plays out. And so, like, Andreas Hale, who covers MMA, he wrote something for Sport News about Covington and everything that he's been doing. And my understanding is he's the only person of all the guys that were there who really wrote something about just kind of how noxious all of this stuff was. And of course, that's a black dude who did that and nobody else did. Then cats that cover MMA don't seem to be, they don't know what to do with this, you know? And they're not qualified. I don't know if qualified is the right way to put it. I don't know if they're not willing, whatever it is, but they're not in a position where they're willing to come out here and do anything about that. And so what we do is, like, we put this guy out here, and I think you and I look at it from the standpoint of, we are exposing this man and showing him for what he is. But I don't think that simply laying it out there like that counts as exposure. Like, and the point I made about Andrew's piece about it was, I was like, is it a heel turn if the people don't think you're a heel? Like, it's not like he's doing this stuff and getting booed for it. You know, this isn't like Sergeant Slaughter went out for Iraq. Like, this is not what it is.
I thought you were exceptional on the subject of Deion Sanders going to Jackson State on highly questionable, and I wanted people to sort of hear why it matters to you that Deion, as much as you love parts of Deion and his personality and certainly his play, why him taking this job sounded like it mattered to you.
It did in a lot of ways. Now, one thing that's worth noting and keeping in mind here is that Jackson State is not playing football this year. Perhaps they'll play football next year, but they're not playing football this year. So we got a lot of time before we figure out exactly what is going on here. Got it. However, I need Deion to be in this for the students. It's very, very, very important to me that Deion be in this for the students because I am an HBCU grad. I graduated from Clark Atlanta University. Every morsel of food I have ever eaten in my life has in one way or another come from the HBCU. Like, this matters to me in a very, very significant way. I don't care if we're ever good at football again, you know? Like, people don't realize historically how good HBCU football has been. Jackson State has four Hall of Famers. Four of them. Mississippi Valley State, for example, has two players with legitimate claims to being the best players of all time at their positions. Mississippi State has never had a Hall of Famer. if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure they never had a Hall of Famer. Like, that's the historical significance. But then integration came, and our schools are underfunded. We don't have the money to put on for our athletic departments in the ways that other schools can. We do not have donor bases that allow us to just pass the hat and come around and magically there's going to be a brand new locker room because somebody wrote us a check for $3 million. We ain't got people that's got $3 million to write those checks. That's not what it is. Like, to play the athletics game on the scale that currently exists, I just don't think we can do that. And I don't think that should be our goal, right? Our goal should be to serve the students that we get, to serve the players that we wind up with, and to wind up in a situation and circumstance where I did a story a few years ago where I was writing about HBCUs, and the athletic director of North Carolina Central at the time said, he's like, yeah, this was at the time when this kid named Greg Little, who played for the Browns at North Carolina, but he was like the best player in Durham at the time. He was like, no, they're not going to call me about Greg Little, but you know, this kid over here with a 1.7 GPA or something. Oh, yeah, they'll give me a call then. He's like, if they give us a call, it's like it's either a discipline problem or an emotional problem or a grade problem, but you better believe it's a problem. Right. I would like to get to a place where at the very least we're not having to get like the bargain bin. Right. The all the open box specials in order to try to be competitive. I don't want to have to do that. But at the same time, I grew up, my parents were working at Prairie View at the time where Prairie View wasn't giving scholarships because they got caught cheating and then decided that they weren't giving scholarships and they didn't win a game for 10 years. Which is to say that I grew up around a place where winning at football didn't matter, but the football team still contributed to the culture of the school. And the band and everything else was still there. Like, it was still a thing. You wanted to be better, obviously, but I guess it gave me a perspective and understanding that like being good at football only matters, but so much. So I worry that Deion, who wants to be a big time college football coach, this ain't no 20 year job for him. I worry about guys like that coming in, playing it like it's short and doing all kinds of things and then dipping out. And then their problems left for whoever comes next. And so I want it that is important to me that if Deion's going to do this job, keep in mind that Deion is not a person with attachments to an HBCU, right? He's from Fort Myers, Florida. I don't think there's an HBCU around there. He went to Florida State. I'm sure that he dated some girls from FAMU, but it's not the same thing, you know, but this isn't in his blood in the ways that it is for most of the people that are around these schools. And so I fear that he's going to make a short run play that could possibly embarrass the institution. And I think it's very important to get him to be declarative about the fact that he is in this for these players and in this for the larger campus community. Because if he's in it for himself, I got bad news for him. The only person to ever parlay an HBCU job into an FBS job is a dude named Jay Hobson. He's white, right? And he coached at Alcorn, and I made a mistake on television. I've corrected it a little bit on Twitter, but I'll do it again here. I used the phrase bunch of hoodlums to refer to some of Jay Hobson's recruiting, and bunch of hoodlums was the wrong phrase for me to use. But what Jay Hobson did do, and this is the point that I was trying to make, that rape scandal at Vanderbilt, that was a big thing a few years ago. While that was being adjudicated, Hobson brought one of those boys to Alcorn. Nah, man. Like, you can't endanger the campus community in the name of building your football team, right? And that's not the only example of a move that he made. There was a thing apparently also after Hobson left, but still his players, an ugly brawl in the cafeteria that happened or whatever. So I apologize for conveying the idea that I was saying that every player they had was a hoodlum or something like that. That's not what I meant, but I get why you thought that. I'm a professional communicator. It's my fault for not saying it right. But my point is that Hobson was making a short run play to use that campus for his own benefit, and whatever mess was created, he left there. And that worries me about Deion.
Well, is there ever in the history of sport a guy who is more about himself in some ways than Deion Sanders? Like, that seems like a reasonable concern to have for all the reasons you enumerated, but also because, yeah, Deion's about Deion. Deion's always been about Deion.
And they also had him on First Take yesterday, and they apparently played what I said, and apparently he called me a hater. I didn't see it, but apparently he called me a hater and then said that he's not in it for him, that this is God's plan. And I'm like, ooh, I'm convinced now. Whoa, oh, that's all I needed to hear, Deion. No, man, no, no. And honestly, I can't see how there's anybody in the world who would view what I say as being a problem in any way whatsoever. Like, if you care more about winning football games than you care about the large community, man, f*** you.
Okay, that is the dismount on that topic. We can move on to another one because I was curious about your thoughts on everything going on in the Pittsburgh Steelers locker room, because this is a tough one, Bo. You got an Army Ranger putting something different on his helmet than the other guys, and who's going to say something to him? Like, how do you say something to him when he's honoring a war hero who heads into a fire and ends up in a situation where he's saving, you know, several men, half a dozen men, and he's coming out with 72% burns and then dying shortly thereafter? Like, what do you say and how do you say it?
You couldn't wait till salute to service, though? Like, one thing about it is, you can't ever tell me that there are not adequate opportunities to talk about the military in football. Yeah, you're not going to act like, well, what other chance was I going to have to do this? You were going to have plenty of other chances to do this. And then he decided that this was the time that he was going to do it, talking about Villanueva. This is the second time he's done something like this. The last time they said it was an accident where they all decided they were going to stay in the locker room for the national anthem. And then he just couldn't help himself. He had to come out there to do it. Something tells me that they could still hear the national anthem in the locker room. Like, if he wanted to do that, he could have stood up there and did his whole thing to honor the flag in the national anthem. He could have showed all the reference and everything else that he wanted to, but he wanted to be seen. It's hard for me to divorce from that. And I said it at the time. I was like, I don't know what he's trying to do, because you have to couch everything you say about Villanueva. I don't know what he was trying to do, but he hijacked that and he put Tomlin in an awful situation because the whole team decided they were going to do something, but now this doesn't apply to you. And so now we get to football. I mean, get to this thing that happened this time, and he did the exact same thing. He taped over this other kid's name and decided to put the name of this soldier. And great, but why? You didn't have to do this right now. You had all kinds of other opportunities to do this. You didn't have to do this right now. But nobody, like in media, is going to be the one to ask these questions. And Tomlin can't win this. No matter how Tomlin feels about this, he ain't winning no PR fight against the soldier. It ain't. It's just the dude who did three tours as a Ranger in Afghanistan. He's not going to win that PR fight against that guy. But it's just wild to me that the Steelers are all about uniformity and football teams are all about uniformity. And by the way, the military is all about uniformity. The military man is the one who once again decided that the uniformity did not apply to him. And it can feel like he is using his service as a shield for what is actually in opposition to this larger movement. And I would like for someone in a position to ask him some questions about that, to ask him that, except who's going to ask the Army Ranger about these things? Like, he wasn't as transparent as Eifert was in Jacksonville, where you put David Dorn's name on his helmet. Like, that's a straight ahead Fox News talking point on that one. And that ain't have nothing. Neither of those things had anything to do with what the weekend was or what they were doing. But that one had nothing at all to do what we're doing, except to use as an oppositional talking point. That was Tyler Eifert giving the middle finger to what the league is doing right now. And nobody did anything about it.
Did you do a parting shot on
I did that
because I didn't see that one. I was going to say, I have not heard that. Like, it demands that Villanueva be at least asked some questions. No. And yeah, then like, you don't hear his voice on these things.
No, we cowards, man. Like, when it really comes to it, who in Pittsburgh is going to be the one to go ask Alejandro Villanueva why it is that you're doing this? Like, I would honestly love to hear what his answer is, because what happened with the thing in Pittsburgh is the kid whose names that they put on their helmets, apparently he has been alleged to have been involved in a drive-by shooting immediately before. But the prosecutors in Pittsburgh, everybody says that when he was running away, that he was not in furtherance of a crime. But either way it goes, if he was involved in a drive-by shooting, you're not allowed to shoot people in the middle of the street because you accuse them of shooting somebody else. Like, you can't do that. That's not allowed. And what it shows at every turn, and this is why the idea of Black Lives Matter as a statement becomes so important. White folks look for every reason in the world to not care about what happens to Black people. You know, so that right there, his dude was running away, got shot in the back. You should want justice, right? Like, you should want him to have to get a trial or deal with the horrors of jail or everything else, right? No. You don't want that, because then you'd have to care even for a brief moment that a Black person died. And at every turn, what you'll find in these responses to when something like this happens, whether it be George Floyd, whether it be Jacob Blake, why should I not care about this person? Why does this Black person not matter to me?
Or deserve it, right? When we go through the criminal records, why does this Black person deserve something that feels unjust?
But the moral of the story is, you're not supposed to care about black people. And here's the reminder of why you're not supposed to care about them. And that's what these always come down to. And so what a cat like Villanueva and what Eifert were doing is, well, I'm not saying that black people don't matter. David Dorn is black. And so, you know, this, forget the gentleman's name.
I forget it as well.
I was in Iraq. Yeah. But they're like, well, he's black. Like that's the shield that they're using, but they're using them to say that these other people just don't matter, that they are above caring about these people. And that's the part that we try to fix and the part that we try to get past. But in order to do that, you're going to unfortunately have to call some white people racist, right? Like you're going to have to directly challenge some people and get them to a point where there's no way to say anything other than what you're doing is racist. And white people have no interest in engaging in that activity.
A light dismount here. I just want to hear, because we haven't actually talked about it, how much you love Tyler Hero.
Oh, dude, I'm enjoying this. You know, I don't always know how I feel about the white dudes that kick it like Tyler Hero, except for the fact that, dog, he means it. Right. Like he sees the 100% mean it. And even if he didn't kick it the way that he kicks it, I just can't believe how confident he is. Like the way that he approached that game, those shots he was taking. Like I told you this about Porter in Denver when he made that shot over in game six. I forget who took it over.
Anthony Davis, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, this was in the Clipper series. It may have been over Paul George, but he's got the ball basically 27 feet away. And just puts it up with no fear after having not made a shot. I was like, that is a shot a superstar takes. Tyler Hero is out here doing superstar level stuff at 20 years old. And what I want to know is why didn't he? I mean, I know why he didn't, but he originally committed to go to Wisconsin before he went to Kentucky. Do you know how confused everybody would have been trying to reconcile Tyler Hero with what they think about Wisconsin and all the other stuff? Like, you know how embarrassed he would have been by them dudes that's out here running around trying to take them charges? Like, you imagine it would have been like the first time somebody told Tyler Hero to go out there and act like that. He spent his whole life separating himself from white dudes like those. That's why he couldn't go. He's like, I ain't gonna think I'm one of them.
I don't know how to explain him emerging from Wisconsin. I just don't understand what happened.
Have you seen like the pictures of his parents?
I've not.
There's no explanation, man. Like I always say, like, so where did you get radicalized? Because it sounds like he got radicalized before he got to Kentucky. I don't know who was on his AAU team, whatever it is, but I am wild confused. When he got drafted, wasn't he the one talking about, you know, people don't make it, like, you know, people don't make it where I'm from. From where? What are you talking about?
All right, Bomani.
By the way, since you mentioned it, the Heat are, like, they only play four of them regularly, but the Heat out here with five white dudes about to go to the NBA Finals. Like, every time somebody say white dudes can't hoop, they got five of them.
Well, and it must make Boston in particular crazy, right? I mean, Olynyk smells like kombucha, and he's out there like, I mean.
It used to be theirs.
No, but how about this? But how about the idea that the unicorn was supposed to be Gordon Hayward, and now it's Tyler Hero? Can you imagine Boston looking at that, saying, wait a minute, we just got a guy named Gordon with a ridiculous mustache. How'd they get him? We had a chance to draft him.
I have wondered if the Boston fans, like, how much happier they would be with their team if they had the Miami roster, right? Like, if they had Miami's roster with all of those guys, and they got all the different kinds of white dudes. They got Dragic coming from the other country. They got Myers Leonard, who I'm not going to call a big white stiff, but is in the archetype. You got Kelly Olynyk, where you're not exactly sure what he's good at, but he'd be out there. Duncan Robinson, the spot-up shooter. And Tyler Hero, the one we can't explain. Like, no matter what kind of white guy, they like In Vogue. Like, In Vogue is like, yo, if you're into black women, we got one of just about every type right here for you. That's what the Heat have. They got the white basketball sampler platter.
See you later, Bomani. Thank you for doing this with us.
All good, man.